Dozens of Panthers poured out of their storefront office swinging clubs, chains, and baseball bats. Quote, "The police got there fairly quickly and tried to separate us," said Bieber. "I got a broomstick broken over my head," unquote. As the fracas began, Kahane scrambled on top of the Hertz truck with a bullhorn, yelling various JDL slogans and slinging crude slurs at the Panthers. "When it looked like it was getting really hairy, Kahane ordered us back into the truck and we drove off," said Bieber. Again quoting, "I don't remember Kahane being involved in any fighting," unquote. Film reports of the JDL's tangle with the Panthers led the local evening TV news programs. Unelated, Kahane later boasted to reporters that because the Black Panthers now properly feared the JDL, quote, "then black hoodlums everywhere would think twice about acting against Jews, and that was precisely our purpose," unquote. The FBI, too, was pleased. Kahane was the perfect stooge. Whether or not he participated unwittingly in the FBI's plot, his racist sentiments were perfectly in tune with those of the men who ran the Bureau. In a May 21, 1970 congratulatory memo to Hoover under the heading, quote, "tangible results," unquote, the FBI's New York Bureau chief reported, quote, "on 5770, approximately 35 members of the JDL picketed the Harlem branch of the BPP in New York City. The purpose of this demonstration was to show that the JDL feels the BPP is anti-Semitic in its acts and words. In view of the above action by the JDL, it is felt that some of the counterintelligence measures of the NYO have produced tangible results," unquote. Skipping down, the conduit for the JDL's intelligence gathering was usually a member or sympathizer of Menachem Begin's Gahal Party, the large right-wing opposition bloc in Israel. Although Begin didn't publicly support the JDL's violent activities in America, privately he professed great admiration for the fiery American rabbi. Begin's affinity to the JDL was quite logical. Many adults in the JDL had been Bitarniks, and some JDL members were very prominent in the revisionist movement which Begin, as Yabotinsky's heir, headed. And note again that we are now seeing a forming of links between the JDL and Israeli intelligence, and indeed the movements which grew directly out of the Beit Harim, the revisionist Zionists, many elements of which were explicitly fascist. So as we move from activities connected with American blacks, and note again the use of the Kahane organization against the Black Panther Party, and indeed note that both, traditionally at least, both Jews and blacks have been pillars of the progressive political movement in the United States. The Kahane organization working to generate friction between blacks and Jews, just as the Nation of Islam under Elijah Muhammad and Louis Farrakhan have done on the opposite side. We are now going to move to the JDL activities in conjunction with not only Israeli intelligence, but also the Beit Harim, the organization founded by Vladimir Yabotinsky, whose most significant graduate was Menachem Begin, who was basically, as noted here, Yabotinsky's heir. Among the activities that the JDL engaged in was spying on Palestinian sympathizers in the United States. So note again that Meir Kahane was not only the ideological successor to the Beit Harim, but actually the practical evolutionary successor as well. Another of the activities that Meir Kahane engaged in, which served the agenda of the American far right, was the attempted disruption of the mayoral campaign of John Lindsay. John Lindsay was a liberal Republican who ran as an independent Republican on the Liberal Party ticket. Mayor Lindsay was very sympathetic to the needs of ethnic minorities in New York City, and had worked out a very effective coalition between people of color and other elements of the progressive community, and as such was targeted by the American far right. He lost the support of the Republican Party per se, and as we shall see, the JDL was employed in, JDL became engaged in generating anti-Lindsay sentiment on the part of New York's very significant Jewish community. Note again that, throughout almost his entire political career, Meir Kahane and his organization basically served the aims of the American far right and the intelligence community, including the aims of explicitly fascist elements. And note again the hard political connections between Meir Kahane and the Beitar organization of Vladimir Yabotinsky that we looked at in the first installment of Strange Bedfellows. Robert Friedman writes as follows in The False Prophet of the activities on behalf of the activities of Meir Kahane against the liberal administration of John Lindsay. We find the following. In 1969, after losing the Republican Party's mayoral primary because of his pro-minority views, Lindsay ran for re-election on the Liberal Party ticket. Week after week, Kahane, who backed Republican candidate John Markey, M-A-R-C-H-I, hammered away at Lindsay in the Jewish Press. That's a publication that's in italics here. It's not the Jewish Press generically, but specifically a newspaper called the Jewish Press. Beginning again. Week after week, Kahane, who backed Republican candidate John Markey, hammered away at Lindsay in the Jewish Press, accusing him of being a vicious anti-Semite. The JDL's well-financed anti-Lindsay crusade didn't stop there. It took out several anti-Lindsay advertisements in the New York Times, distributed tens of thousands of anti-Lindsay flyers, and dispatched, quote, truth squads, unquote, to attend the mayor's public speaking engagements where they mercilessly heckled him, quote, "We're going to make it impossible for him, Lindsay, to be mayor of this city," unquote, Kahane vowed. Meanwhile, the FBI continued to send out thousands of pieces of hate mail to black and white teachers in order to keep the pot boiling. On October 15, 1969, 1,700 people crammed into the East Midwood Jewish Center, where they jeered Lindsay as he tried to explain his reasons for supporting school decentralization. According to a front-page account in the New York Times, the mayor stood with facial muscles twitching, one white-knuckled hand gripping the podium, and shouted while he pointed at a teachers' union officer, quote, "Our city will not survive if teachers are illegally transferred any more than it will if this gentleman here leads the teachers in an illegal strike. I say to you that there have been acts of vigilantism on both sides," unquote. The crowd, filled with rabidly anti-Lindsay JDLers, surged towards the stage, forcing the mayor to flee by a side door. Quote, "It was a very ugly situation," recalled Sid Davidoff, a top aide to Lindsay from 1966 to 1973. "We had to use a decoy car to get Lindsay out of there. The JDL used this incident as a springboard to sabotage the mayor's appearances in other Jewish areas," unquote. Kahane's polarizing tactics began to erode Lindsay's support even among more mainstream Jews, who represented the largest liberal voting bloc in the city. Quote, "The JDL was beating the hell out of us," Davidoff told me. "They were killing us in the polls," unquote. Desperate to get Kahane off the mayor's back, at least until after the election, Lindsay aides cut a deal with Jewish press publisher Shalom Klass, K-L-A-S-S. "I sold my soul for that," said Davidoff, now a prominent New York lawyer. Marvin Schick arranged a private meeting between the mayor and Klass, who was chauffeured to Gracie Mansion in Lindsay's limousine. After taking the publisher on a tour of the mansion, Lindsay asked Klass for his political support. According to Marvin Schick, quote, "Klass, who was stuttering," he was a terrible stutterer, said, "But Mayor Lindsay, my readers think you're anti-Semitic," unquote. Quote, now quoting Lindsay's reply, "Rabbi Klass, what do you think?" asked Lindsay, a vein in his neck pulsing and his face turning deep red, according to Schick. "My readers think that," replied Klass. "But what do you think?" Lindsay asked, glaring sharply. "Well, my readers," Klass repeated, "if that's what you think, I feel sorry for you," said Lindsay, who stalked out of the room. So again, note the activities of Meyer Kahane and the JDL in working to fragment the traditional progressive alliance between blacks and Jews. Note their attempts to disrupt John Lindsay's progressive administration and campaign. Note also the provocative role, as cited here, of the FBI. Friedman notes, meanwhile, the FBI continued to send out thousands of pieces of hate mail to black and white teachers in order to keep the pot boiling. This of New York City's school crisis in the late 60s and 70s. Next, we're going to look at the deepening pattern of collaboration between, first of all, Meyer Kahane and the JDL, and Israeli intelligence, and elements of the Zionist movement in Israel that were explicitly allied with not only the Beitar, but also the even more militant Stern Gang. And the activities that we're going to look at now on behalf of the JDL and Meyer Kahane were a program of attacks on Soviet institutions and installations in the United States in order to pressure the Soviet Union to grant better treatment to its Jewish population and to pressure the Soviet Union to permit increased Jewish emigration to Israel. Note that these attacks worked to disrupt détente. They endangered détente between the United States and the Soviet Union, once again serving the agenda of the American far right. Now, you're going to hear a couple of names here. Bernard Deutsch, he was an American member of the IL RRJJ, the International League for the Repatriation of Russian Jews, obviously a Zionist organization. Also, the Cohen referred to here is a female member of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, named Geula Cohen. I'm not sure how that's pronounced, G-E-U-L-A. Now, note that she was one of the people, along with Deutsch, who recruited Meir Kahane to begin his program of anti-Soviet attacks, or to commit the JDL to anti-Soviet attacks. And note here, the working relationship between Meir Kahane, Geula Cohen, and Yitzhak Shamir, who was actually a member of the Stern Gang, as was Geula Cohen. Note again that the Stern Gang had for a time actually advocated a wartime alliance between the Third Reich and the Zionist movement to drive the British out of Palestine, just as Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Stern Gang's opposite number in the Palestinian movement, actually formed a wartime alliance with Nazi Germany. Returning to The False Prophet by Robert Friedman, the secret relationship between Cohen, Shamir, and Kahane was forged one blustery cold morning in December of 1969. Cohen, who had just been elected to the Knesset as a member of Menachem Begin's Herut party, visited Kahane in his cramped JDL office on Manhattan's Fifth Avenue. At the time, Cohen thought that Kahane was frittering away his talents. Quote, "Why are you wasting time fighting the Schwarzers?" unquote, asked Cohen, who was in America on a speaking tour sponsored by the International League for the Repatriation of Russian Jews, or ILRRJ, a group of Jewish businessmen and Orthodox rabbis who were lobbying Congress on behalf of Soviet Jews. Cohen, who in the 1940s had dropped out of Begin's Irgun Underground to fight with the more extreme Stern Gang because she found Begin, quote, too mild, unquote, told Kahane that the vital issue for Jews is the plight of Soviet Jewry. "The Russians are planning to liquidate our people," unquote. The meeting between them was arranged by Bernard Deutsch, a founding member of the ILRRJ, who says Cohen was impressed by Kahane's militant credentials and obvious public relations talent. Although the JDL was enjoying success as an anti-black protest group, Kahane instinctively grasped that the predicament of Soviet Jews was an issue that could generate international headlines and turn the JDL into a more significant force. Now, Cohen was offering him the chance to ride his brethren's concern for Soviet Jewry to stardom. Quote, "I really influenced him," unquote, Cohen told me in Jerusalem in October of 1988. Again quoting, "He changed the JDL's program overnight," unquote. During the next few months, Cohen said, she helped lay the groundwork for a guerrilla war against the Soviet Union that would be waged by the JDL and orchestrated by prominent right-wing Israelis, including several high-ranking members of Mossad. Cohen and Deutsch told me that the group's central player was the quiet, morose, former Stern Gang commander Yitzhak Shamir. Of course, later Yitzhak Shamir went on to become Prime Minister of Israel. Continuing, Shamir had been Mossad's chief of operations until 1965 and maintained close ties with the agency. "The JDL's decisions weren't made by Meyer," said Deutsch, a key member of the covert group that oversaw the JDL's anti-Soviet operations. "If I were to tell you that Shamir was the head of our group and planned our activities, he would absolutely deny it. But I sat on his bed in his bedroom, which is where we had many of our meetings. I'm not looking to hurt Shamir, but that's a fact," unquote. When I asked Shamir in October of 1988 to comment about his activities with the JDL, his spokesman said the Prime Minister would not confirm or deny allegations about his involvement with the organization. Shamir's spokesman did say, however, that the Prime Minister was very sympathetic to the JDL's early work on behalf of Soviet Jews. So note again that we actually find here Menachem Begin and the JDL working with people like Yitzhak Shamir, who, just like Menachem Begin, were actually members of the fascist element of the Zionist movement, and we're watching them working together here not only with Israeli intelligence, elements of the Mossad, but we're finding them working in a capacity which benefited the agenda of the American far right, namely disrupting detente and embarrassing the Soviet Union. More of the JDL versus the USSR program of agitation and eventually outright violent attacks. Continuing, Kahane's handlers calculated that the selective use of violence against Soviet targets in America and Europe would inevitably strain U.S.-Soviet relations, according to former JDL officials. They predicted that rather than risk détente, the Soviet Union would be forced to alleviate the crisis by freeing hundreds of thousands of Jews who would then be herded to the Jewish state. An influx of Soviet Jews could help redress the demographic imbalance caused when Israel swallowed the occupied territories with its large Arab population. Since the founding of the State of Israel, one of Mossad's prime directives has been to help bring Jews to Israel. It has operated underground networks in a number of countries, including Iraq and Ethiopia, to facilitate this task. What we're going to look at next is the disapproval of the Israeli government's, the labor government of Israel under Golda Meir for the JDL's activities, worth noting under the circumstances. Golda Meir's labor government was apparently kept in the dark about this covert cabal of right-wing zealots. Golda Meir had favored using back-channel diplomacy to solve the Soviet-Jewish problem, Deutsch said. Again quoting, many revisionists felt that it was exactly that kind of passive policy that led to the Holocaust. The Israeli government did nothing for Soviet Jews. Golda felt any kind of publicity endangered their lives. Quote, I make decisions that can send thousands of Israeli soldiers to their death, but I have no right to do that to Russian Jews, unquote, she once told me. We thought militancy was the way to go, unquote. Deutsch's involvement in this secret operation grew out of his long-standing ties to the leader of the revisionist Zionist movement. During the late 1960s and early 1970s, Deutsch was a prominent member of Brooklyn's Orthodox Jewish community. He was a confidant of a root leader, Menachem Begin, who slept in Deutsch's home whenever he was in New York on business, and was the chairman of the B'nai B'rith Anti-Defamation League's powerful Brooklyn chapter. His work on behalf of Soviet Jews was highly regarded. Malcolm Henlein, H-O-E-N-L-E-I-N, now executive director of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, said that Deutsch's ILRRJ, quote, made an important contribution. They were activists when there weren't that many people involved, unquote. One of ILRRJ's key contacts was Richard Perle, Henry Scoop Jackson's Senate aide, who went on to become a top Pentagon official in the Reagan administration. So note again that Bernard Deutsch is also affiliated with the revisionist Zionists, that element of the Zionist movement headed up by Vladimir Jabotinsky and the Beitar. Note that he was very close to Menachem Begin, the most important graduate of the Beitar or alumnus of the Beitar. Note that Begin used to stay at his home. And note also that one of the key contacts for the ILRRJ was Richard Perle, who became one of the luminaries in Ronald Reagan's Pentagon, okay? The Pentagon under Ronald Reagan. Perle, a dyed-in-the-wool Cold Warrior. So again, note the pattern of activity of Meir Kahane and the JDL working in conjunction with, first of all, American intelligence and the far right, including explicitly fascist elements and elements which later went on to become prominent with the Reagan and Bush administrations. Note the collaboration of Kahane with various elements of U.S. intelligence, including FBI and CIA. Note the collaboration of Kahane and his JDL and other elements with Israeli intelligence. And beyond that, note that the Kahane organization and organizations, perhaps, because there were more than one, are not only the ideological successors, but the direct evolutionary successors to organizations like the Beitar of Vladimir Jabotinsky and the Stern Gang associated with Yitzhak Shamir. Shamir and Begin working directly with Meir Kahane and his organizations. More about the JDL's attacks on Soviet targets. The JDL's opening shot was a well-executed attack on four Soviet targets in New York. In one day, December 29, 1969, the JDL simultaneously took over the offices of TASS, the Soviet press agency, Intourist, the Soviet tourist agency, and Aeroflot, the Soviet airline, and boarded a Russian commercial passenger plane at Kennedy International Airport to spray paint the cabin with Hebrew slogans like, Am Yisrael Chai, the Jewish nation lives, unquote. The next day, more than 100 JDL members rioted in front of the Soviet mission in New York. In a press release, Kahane explained the JDL's actions. Our attacks upon the institutions of Soviet tyranny in America represent the first step in our campaign to bring the issue of oppressed Soviet Jews and other religious groups to the attention of an apathetic public and indifferent news media. We have pleaded, implored, and tried the traditional methods of diplomacy. They have failed to open the gates. There is little remaining for us to do, but to heed the requests of Russian Jews themselves, who have commanded us to shake the world, unquote. On December 31st, the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister S.P. Kozyrev, K-O-Z-Y-R-E-V, met with the U.S. Ambassador to the Soviet Union to protest at the JDL attacks, warning that if they did not cease, quote, the responsibility will rest fully on the U.S. government, unquote. But the JDL intensified its campaign. A few days after an angry Kozyrev dressed down the U.S. official in Moscow, Kahane sent separate telegrams to U.S. Secretary of State William Rogers and Soviet Ambassador to the U.S. Anatoly Dobrynin, vowing the JDL would disrupt all Soviet cultural appearances in the U.S. unless the Soviet Jews were freed. So note again the effects of the JDL campaign on detente, endangered detente, again serving the agenda of the American far right, with which, quite obviously, Menachem Begin, Meir Kahane, and his organizations have been affiliated. Next, we're going to take a look at an observation of a fellow named Barry Lieben, the head of the Beitar, who tabs Meir Kahane as the explicit successor to Vladimir Yabotinsky, the founder of Beitar. Quote, I couldn't keep my kids away from Kahane, said Barry Lieben, then head of Beitar, who looked on helplessly as his organization began to merge into the JDL in the early 1970s. One more time. I couldn't keep my kids away from Kahane, said Barry Lieben, then head of Beitar, who looked on helplessly as his organization began to merge into the JDL, in the early 1970s. Kahane is the closest thing on earth to Yabotinsky. I grew up reading the work of Yabotinsky. Then all of a sudden, there was Kahane, an animated version of Yabotinsky, right in front of you, unquote. But Yabotinsky was not obsessed with blacks like Kahane. Even at the height of the JDL's war against the Soviet Union, Kahane could not resist meddling in black Jewish affairs. After all, it was the fear that black demands for equality would somehow sabotage Jewish achievements that had brought the clique of revisionists, school teachers, Orthodox Jews, and wealthy businessmen together under the banner of the JDL in the first place. Skipping down, we're next going to look at one of the most startling alliances of the Jewish Defense League of Meir Kahane, namely its alliance with the Italian-American Civil Rights League that was founded by New York City mafioso Joseph Colombo Sr. and staffed by a fair number of Colombo's street lieutenants. On May 12, 1971, Kahane and a dozen other JDL members were arrested by federal agents in New York for conspiracy to manufacture explosives. It was no accident that on the very next day, Kahane publicly announced that the JDL was joining forces with another right-wing group, the Italian-American Civil Rights League, or IACRL. This unholy alliance was the first serious attempt to forge an ethnic fascist movement in modern American history. One more time. On May 12, 1971, Kahane and a dozen other JDL members were arrested by federal agents in New York for conspiracy to manufacture explosives. It was no accident that on the very next day, Kahane publicly announced that the JDL was joining forces with another right-wing group, the Italian-American Civil Rights League, or IACRL. This unholy alliance was the first serious attempt to forge an ethnic fascist movement in modern American history. The IACRL was founded by New York City mob boss Joseph Colombo Sr. to instill pride in Italian Americans and to counteract the notion that Italians in America were gangsters. It mattered little to Colombo's supporters that he had begun his career as a mob hitman and worked his way up to control one of the five most powerful mafia families in New York. For months at a time, Colombo and his followers, many of them burly teamsters and longshoremen, picketed FBI headquarters to demand, among other things, that the Bureau stop using the word mafia, which they declared was a myth created by overzealous federal prosecutors to justify their huge budgets. So powerful did the IACRL become that New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller, New York Congresswoman Bella Abzug, and New York Democratic leader Meade Esposito, among other influential politicians, were guests at its parades, banquets, and demonstrations. Soon, IACRL stickers appeared on storefronts of Italian-American-owned businesses across the city. On November 20, 1970, the IACRL sponsored a star-studded benefit at Madison Square Garden. Headlined by Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. and hosted by Tonight Show MC Ed McMahon, the event raised more than $600,000 for the IACRL. Ticket holders that night included mafia heavyweights Carlo Gambino, Russell Bufalino, and Raymond Patriarca, as well as political luminaries such as New York Deputy Richard Aurelio and Paul O'Dwyer, and Paul O'Dwyer, former Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate. And skipping down still more, skipping down still further, I should say, more on the JDLIACRL alliance. In the months that followed Kahane's conviction, the rabbi and the mob boss became, Slotnick says, quote, close and good friends. The heart of the relationship, as far as Kahane was concerned, was easy access to illegal weapons and money. Quote, the JDL got weapons and money, tons of money from Colombo, unquote, said Irving Calderon, C-A-L-D-E-R-O-N. Quote, Colombo thought he got respect from being seen with a famous rabbi, even though at the time most Jews didn't respect Kahane. Colombo got something more from his association with Kahane than, quote, respect, unquote. Some of the JDL's toughest members worked as strong-arm men and loan collectors for the Colombo family, said Zvibon, or Zvibon, Z-W-E-I-B-O-N, quote, they wanted us to do muscle work for them, like collecting loan shark debts, unquote, confirmed Calderon. Our boys were unknown to the victims and didn't mind breaking kneecaps. Calderon also said that Colombo helped the JDL carry out several of its terrorist missions, though he would not say which ones. Our close relationship with Colombo gave us more clout, said Calderon. People are afraid of the mafia. It gave groups like the Black Panthers something to consider. One of the rationales Kahane used, and we promoted, was the precedent of Jabotinsky dealing with Mussolini before World War II. Kahane would say, quote, if Jabotinsky could deal with Mussolini, we can deal with Colombo. So note here that the political alliance between Joseph Colombo, a New York mob boss, and his IACRL, and Meyer Kahane and his JDL, actually became a tactical operational alliance, with some of the tougher members of the JDL actually working as enforcers for Colombo, and Colombo's organization apparently also participating in some of the JDL's attacks. And note, again, this last couple of sentences. One of the rationales Kahane used and we promoted was the precedent of Jabotinsky dealing with Mussolini before World War II. Kahane would say, quote, if Jabotinsky could deal with Mussolini, we can deal with Colombo, unquote. Indeed, once again, I note that not only was Meyer Kahane and his organization the successor, ideologically, to Vladimir Jabotinsky and the Beitar and the Stern Gang, but that there are actual hard operational connections. The Kahane family actually were tight with Jabotinsky, Joseph Cherba, and Meyer Kahane, members of the Beitar, and, of course, graduates of such organizations as the Beitar and the Stern Gang, such as Yitzhak Shamir, Menachem Begin, Geula Cohen, working directly with Meyer Kahane's organizations. And, indeed, note that the Colombo and Kahane alliance being compared with the alliance between Jabotinsky and Mussolini prior to World War II. Eventually, of course, Meyer Kahane and his organization made their way to Israel, and we're going to close our examination of Meyer Kahane and his political resume by, in a sense, waving goodbye as he goes to Israel. In August of 1971, Kahane announced he was moving to Israel. Quote, it was impossible for me to tell people to go to Israel without going myself, unquote, he later said to me, skipping down. As the Jewish militants turned onto the ramp leading to the airport, they heard a news bulletin on the car radio about a JDL member who had been apprehended by federal authorities for making illegal weapons purchases. That afternoon, several young JDLers joined Kahane on his journey to Israel rather than face the authorities. Quote, that was the modus operandi, says Sternberg. You get in trouble here, and you go to Israel. Well, eventually, of course, followers of Meyer Kahane in Israel they've enjoyed a fair amount of political success, and at least one of those followers, Baruch Goldstein, engaged in an act of terrorism, of course. He machine-gunned, he massacred a bunch of Muslims who were at prayer. There remain questions about collaboration on the part of elements of the Israeli authorities. There appears to have been a second gun, at least from information that has surfaced so far. I would note, too, that the Baruch Goldstein attack has provoked a series of reciprocal attacks by the reactionary and fascist-linked counterparts in the Palestinian movement. And in numerous archive shows, as I have said, we have looked at the explicitly fascist and Nazi connections of the more extreme elements of the Palestinian national movement as well. Note that in response to the Baruch Goldstein shooting, we have seen a number of brutal terrorist acts in reprisal for the Baruch Goldstein incident, and that those incidents have jeopardized the Middle East peace process, which actually continues, though, under the circumstances. Another thing that's interesting to me is the fact that Sheikh Rahman's milieu, which assassinated Meir Kahane, Mr. Nosair, was a follower of Sheikh Rahman, and in fact the connections of Nosair to Sheikh Rahman were covered up in the investigation into Meir Kahane's assassination, because the milieu of Sheikh Rahman is also deeply connected to U.S. intelligence, as we have looked at in not only these, as we looked at in Radio Free America program number 38 and supplements to that. It's interesting to also see an attack on some yeshiva students in New York City that took place. There was a machine pistol attack on a busload of yeshiva students in New York City. It remains to be determined whether that was in reprisal for the Baruch Goldstein shooting, although it appears that that was the case. It will be interesting, too, to see what the ultimate results of the Middle East peace process turn out to be. Certainly, the fascist-linked elements of the Zionist movement in the person of Meir Kahane and his followers — Meir Kahane, of course, is dead, but his followers are still very much on the scene — and the fascist-linked elements of the Palestinian National Movement in the person of the more militant elements of that movement, they are, at this point, working ostensibly against each other, but actually they are working, they are indeed strange bedfellows. The people, the elements such as Hamas, the more militant elements of the Palestinian National Movement, and the more militant elements of the Zionist movement are indeed strange bedfellows, and as opposed to each other as they profess to be, they are actually working towards the same practical goal, namely disrupting the peace process. And it is interesting to contemplate the possible role of third parties in this strange situation. Certainly, the Nazis and fascists, which in the World War II period had sponsored elements like Haj Amin al-Husseini on the one side, and elements like the Stern Gang and the Beitar on the other, they certainly were no friends of either Jews or Arabs. And as I noted in the original installment of Strange Bedfellows, there are explicitly fascist elements in the United States, including elements deeply involved with the Reagan and Bush administrations, which have supported, through the intelligence community, the milieu of Sheikh Rahman on the one side, and also the milieu of Meir Kahane and his associates on the other. Ultimately, the goals of the fascists that have formed alliances with the more extreme elements of the Palestinian National Movement, the more extreme elements of the Black Power Movement, and also the more extreme elements of the Zionist Movement, would like to see Zionists, or would like to see Jews, Blacks, and Arabs either suppressed or completely eliminated. And I think it is incumbent on the more intelligent members of all of those groups to take stock of their political history, to take stock of the nature of their allies, and to undo the effects of the ideological mystification that the fascists have engaged in. Because ultimately, if the militant Palestinian, militant elements of the Palestinian movement with explicitly fascist and Nazi connections, if the militant elements of the Zionist movement with explicitly fascist and Nazi connections, and with strong connections going to U.S. intelligence, like the militant elements of the Palestinian movement, and if the more militant and less responsible elements of the Black Power Movement, such as the Louis Farrakhan organization, if they do not wake up, then ultimately they are going to suffer the fate of Jews in my considered opinion, they will suffer the fate of Jews in Europe under Hitler, and they will indeed be separate but equal under the circumstances. That concludes the prepared portion of tonight's program. And it also concludes this addendum to the Strange Bedfellows archive show. Now, all of our archive broadcast shows are on permanent file with a tape duplication company. The name of that company is Archives on Audio. That's Archives on Audio. They're located at P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, California, 94117. The phone number is area code 415-346-1840. 415-346-1840. 1-800-346-1840. I should also mention that neither myself nor this station makes any money off of this announcement. This is FYI. This is Dave Emery thanking all the listeners for their contributions and encouraging them to tune in again to the next broadcast. Until then, take care.